All right, welcome to Just Another Bozo on the Bus. I said I wasn't going to announce episode numbers anymore after the last one, so... welcome to the Zen Zone today with Corey Hunt, a friend, colleague.
Sure.
Dear friend of the family. Corey, welcome. Thanks for coming and hanging out with us.
Thanks,
today.
Paul.
And actually, I'm hanging out with you in your territory because
it's true.
We're at your house.
On my home turf.
We're on your home turf. We're in your house in Newport Beach.
It's true. Watch out.
Yeah. Spring break here.
Because I'm in control here.
You're in control. And you know as well as I do the illusions of control is an illusion.
So. What? Uh-oh. I'm going to have to rethink this whole thing.
Yeah, all right. So I'm just going to kind of let you take a moment and however long that moment is and tell us a little bit about your life and your story and what, you know, how you got here. I love that term. How you got here.
Oh, yeah. Wow. How I got here. Wow.
I mean, you grew up in Salt Lake, which is...
Yes, I did. I grew up in Salt Lake. I have two little sisters, mom and dad, you know, family.
Mom and dad. Almost nuclear family.
Almost. Pretty close. Yeah. If only my little sister was half a person, then we would have it. We'd have those 2.5 kids. Pretty normal, like normal, happy kid, I feel like.
I'm just going to roll till you get it.
Just keep going.
I'm just going to roll
just
till you get it.
Go and edit this part out.
So you had to
make me sound cool so in the edit,
you,
Paul.
You are cool. You are cool. I don't need to make you sound cool.
And sort of, I feel like sort of normal high school, like, dabbled in smoking weed, would drink occasionally, like that kind of stuff, if we're getting straight into kind of the recovery story.
Sure. Let's go there.
My childhood wasn't, like, exciting. I just, you know, I read a bunch and, like, didn't have very many friends. That was, there you go. I did it. That was, like, until age, like, 13.
What were you reading? What kind of stuff?
What kind of stuff did I read? When I was real little, well, not real little, but like I remember reading like all of the Wizard of Oz books and the like John Belair's, which is interesting. Like that just came into my consciousness again recently because apparently they're making a House with a Clock in its Walls with Jack Black
and Kate Blanchett.
Appears to be a kid's movie, but it's directed by Eli Roth, which is interesting.
Well, I did see the preview for it, and it has a scare factor, which is pretty high.
Yeah. My son asked me to turn it off. As soon as the trailer started playing, he could tell from the music he didn't want to see it.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't even see the video. He just was immediately like put his hands over his ears and told me to turn it off.
The music is scare worthy is
yeah,
what you're
the music
saying.
Is okay. Spooky enough, okay. Apparently. Yeah, I read a lot. I very specifically remember like going to the Sandy Library all the time with my mom and my sister and picking out books. A lot of Wizard of Oz, like the Narnia books. Like I guess I was into fantasy stuff as a kid, like fantasy and horror. And then got sort of more into sci-fi stuff as I got older a little bit.
I think the Narnia books are a basis for a lot of kids' lives.
just looking for that magic closet.
Yeah, looking for the magic closet. The wardrobe, definitely. Yeah, and everybody wants Aslan of some kind. We're all looking for that, right?
And we all think that Turkish Delight sounds good, and then you try it, and it's not. Edmund, what an idiot!
Yeah. All right. So, grew up normal family.
I'm quote unquote normal. I feel it feels judgy to even say normal family.
Right.
But
every good family has a certain level of dysfunction in it. So, but you have this feeling like you had a bit of a loner side because what you were a little socially awkward. Is that what you're kind of saying? Or you?
I think that was part of it. I also think that growing up in Salt Lake City as a kid who wasn't Mormon, like, I feel like there were a few factors. One, I went to private school, so I didn't go to, like, a local school in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And then also I wasn't part of the Mormon culture. And so, like, I never had, like, neighborhood friends because I didn't really have, like, social opportunities to meet those kids. Uh-huh. Like, those kids, like, every time I interacted with, like, kids in the neighborhood, it was sort of very clear that they already, like, had friends and, like, weren't super interested in making more.
Are you trying to say you didn't know the secret handshake?
Look, I did not know the secret handshake, and I still do not.
Okay. Well, and, yeah, and, but look what you, look, you, I guess you didn't need to know it after all.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there was, I was also, like, I was a very introverted kid. I'm still, like, fairly introverted. So I'm sure had I made more of an effort that I probably could have, like, broken through, but sort of given the circumstances and also sort of my general disposition, I was kind of a loner, like, read a lot of books kind of kid. I was the kind of kid that always had, like, one or two really good friends in school, but, like, not. Yeah.
I think that's a common theme in a thread with a lot of people, especially for those that look for something outside themselves to feel okay with, you know, which is, you know, you talked about you started smoking pot in high school. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Probably like 15. Yeah. 15.
Yeah. And just, do you remember who introduced you to that? You don't have to say their name.
Yes, know. I do.
Okay. Okay, go ahead. Do I know them?
you definitely do. You definitely remember all these kids.
Okay.
Paul, this is where I say that Paul's probably known me since I was like 12 or 13. So
it's true. It's true.
Me and my group of hooligan friends.
Which are actually are my kids as well. So we'll go ahead and say that it's been a long road. And I learned a lot about life by, you know, by developing friends with your kids' friends. Okay. So where did it go from there?
I mean, for a while that was kind of it. Like, we, you know, occasionally, like, get drunk on the weekends or, like, smoke pot, which actually, like, I remember not even liking that much. Like, I was fine with it, but I was just sort of like, I guess this is what people are doing. I'll do it too. But my main recollection is of one time being just super paranoid.
While you were under the influence?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Fair. And like, scared of the cat. Like, I feel like almost all of my marijuana experiences were not good.
Okay.
Like, somewhere in the like range between like neutral and uninteresting to mm-hmm. like paranoid and bad. but also it was like the thing that people were doing, and so occasionally I would do it.
That's a lot of pressure, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to get high, but I also know I'm going to get paranoid.
I also know I'm going to get real weird. Watch out, guys. And yeah, and after that, I feel like it sort of stayed at that level for a long, like, not for a long time. I feel like there was sort of a, like, core group of, like, the quote-unquote stoner kids, for mm-hmm. lack of a, like, a better term. And I was, like, not like part of the group, but I was sort of always welcome mm-hmm. and I kind of dipped in and out, and like at one point like started dating a girl who was Mormon and she wasn't a fan of any of that, and so I was like, oh, okay, well, I like you better than smoking weed, so I guess I'll stop. But it was not like a like it was I didn't like I wasn't I didn't stop cuz like I felt like I should, or it was more just like, oh, okay, I guess I'll not do that anymore.
Well, if, you know, drugs or girl, you know, I mean,
yeah,
because kind of the girls are really good drugs sometimes, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes a relationship can be just as much of a drug. And I'm trying to think of the first time I had, it was probably my junior year of high school. No, it couldn't have been my junior year. It was my sophomore year. I remember this because the kid I was hanging out with when I screwed up my shoulder, he left our school sophomore year. So, like, sophomore year, I, like, screwed up my shoulder skateboarding. We were skateboarding in his garage. I fell and jammed my entire shoulder. And, like, that injury just, like, gradually got worse and worse to the point where, like, my shoulder would dislocate kind of randomly. I remember one time, like, reaching to open a doorknob, and I turned the doorknob and my arm turned weird in a weird way. Uh-huh. And just, like, fell out of the socket.
It literally popped out?
Yeah, literally. Yeah, it doesn't dislocate. There's another word for it because it goes right back in again.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it matters. But eventually I had to have surgery for that. And after surgery, they gave me really good drugs, Paul.
Yeah.
They were great.
They did.
Which I feel, it's interesting. I feel like that is an opioid addiction story that you hear, because this was the 90s. And I feel like this is the one you hear more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
As sort of the opioid epidemic or whatever gets talked about more and more.
This is the beginning of it. There's a great book that talks about the development of this called Dreamland. And it talks about the black tar heroin that was being grown in Mexico and kind of goes up through LA. But one of the next markets that grew out of that was Salt Lake City, even before Portland. It's a fascinating journey, but this is the beginning. This is the beginning. The 90s were the beginning of the opioid epidemic that was beginning to where heroin was beginning to replace the pain, you know, the opiates that were being prescribed by doctors.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, so after, I mean, it was probably Percocet that they gave me after my surgery. And I know, you know, I mean, at first they were just great for not making my arm hurt anymore after surgery. But I also noticed that when I took them, I was not nearly as, like, depressive or anxious, which
really
was also kind of good.
You get that kind of, people talk about that warm blanket feeling.
Oh, yeah. The warm blanket feeling is great.
Yeah.
It was definitely that, like, less anxiety, less sort of, like, mild depressive symptoms or whatever. I mean, it's hard to know when you're 15. I feel like everyone is a mild depressive at 15.
It's true. Well, and we do know that. We do know that being depressed is part of life.
Right.
It's not something we have to necessarily be afraid of.
Right.
But when we're 15 and not sure socially how things are working out and not know exactly how we fit in at times, it can seem bigger and more daunting. So something that can relieve that.
Right. And yeah, and it wasn't like, it was more like, you know, I had, what, I mean, 30 of them or whatever, mm-hmm. let's say 30, and like, I probably took 20 of them, you know, throughout the course of needing them for pain, and then I was like, these are pretty good, I think I'm gonna just save these last, it's not that much pain, I think I'm gonna save these last 10 and sort of space them out, see if I can, it may not have even been that many, but I remember having like a couple extra and just every once in a while I would take one just mm-hmm. to sort of feel better about life. And that was that. Like, it wasn't sort of like a switch was flipped or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it was on my radar.
Yeah.
Well,
you cataloged it. I mean, you had an experience. This whether you want to call it self medication or not. I mean, the self medicating the pain is one aspect of this, but self medicating the emotional aspects or the mental aspects is where this begins to switch. So you go, I know I can keep these and they'll help me feel good at a later time and date.
Right. Exactly. And yeah. And then, you know, sort of didn't really think anything of it for another couple of years until I had to have surgery on my shoulder again, cause I messed it up snowboarding. But again, it was the same sort of thing where I was like, oh, I know I like these, so I'll take the ones I need and save the ones I don't need. And, you know, I was probably like 16, or probably like 17 at that point. And yeah, and again, didn't really think anything of it. And then, moved away for college, then ended up like hating it and coming back to Salt Lake. I worked at a music store for a while, and which I'm sure you remember. I'm sure you remember Tom Tom Music, Paul.
How can I forget it?
But like, ended up like hanging out with this kid who would come in all the time. He was a real like, real weirdo kid, and like, you know, somehow he and I got on the subject of like, hey, you know what's great? Percocet. Those are really good. Who knows how? Like, he would come in all the time, and we would just like listen to Pavement on the overhead speakers and talk about whatever. But then, you know, like, he, you know, he bought somebody's grandma's OxyContin off them before like anyone knew what it was. Mm-hmm. And like, except for us, because like, we were like, this is definitely oxycodone, and we definitely know, right, we like it.
Right. Yeah.
These little, you know, 10 milligram oxys are exactly enough to to like get a good functional buzz off of.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course.
And that, yeah, and that was it. Like, we would be into those whenever he could find them. He was always sort of the like more resourceful. Like, I feel like I at the time didn't actively seek it out, but if it was around, I would definitely do it.
Sure.
And then just one, like, then just one day he was like, oh yeah, I started doing heroin instead. I'm like, oh, that's heroin, huh? That sounds like some serious business. And we just started doing that.
And how were you doing it initially?
Initially, it was black tar heroin. Initially, we would snort it.
Mm-hmm.
But we quickly decided we should start shooting it. Like, if we're gonna do it, let's just do it.
You didn't like make the transition to smoking it. You went right.
No,
from,
we just went. We were right. Just like, huh, why not?
Okay.
Yeah. No, which is not like it was a very like knee jerk, like stupid decision.
Wow.
Of like, I guess if we're gonna do this, we should just really do it. We were like the two people on the entire planet who saw Trainspotting and were like, that seems cool. Let's do that. Let's be those people.
Well, and you had, and of course you have musicians that you know about. We'll talk about music today, but the you already knew through, you know, your experience with different bands and musicians and writers and that there were plenty of them out there doing this drug, and you know.
It's true. I remember being fascinated with William S. Burroughs, like at a young age, like
yes.
15, 16. So yeah, so that I was like, my interest in that was definitely sort of just in the water of my consciousness.
Yeah.
Even though like all of those descriptions of it are like, they're not great. Like I read Junkie before I ever started doing heroin.
Right.
And
right.
Probably like 80% of what he goes through in that book is not good.
Right. Well, it depends on the perspective. I mean, the same thing could be said for Hunter Thompson, right? I mean, even though he glorified in many ways,
right,
you know, drug use and mental illness, it depends. If you're not someone that is, well, let's just say, if you're not someone that's attracted to that kind of madness, then it doesn't maybe stand out in the same way, you know? So the same with Burroughs, I get the same feeling, which I've read, you know, a couple of his books. I'm thinking Naked Lunch, right? No?
Yeah, I mean, okay. That's definitely Burroughs. And Naked Lunch, like, I feel like, yeah, I've read a bunch of his stuff, and I gave up on it a long time ago because it's so out there.
It's dark
too. It's dark, and it's out there, and like the more I read it, the more I was like, I don't even know if this is good. It just seems like crazy and super weird for the time, and it like he sort of ran in the right circles. I don't know. I would have to go back to it, I guess, to decide whether or not I think it's actually good, as if like my opinion of what's good counts for anything.
Well, it's important today, so regardless of any other moment in time and space. All right, so you right from snorting right to the needle,
just right to shooting. Yeah. And that that lasted off and on for probably like 5 years. Like it just, we just like got sucked into it kind of. And I was able to sort of quit and come back out of it a couple times. I remember, probably after a year or two, I went through like a whole hospitalization at uni in Salt Lake.
So did a detox.
Detox there and like, but was still like not a happy person. It ended up being very much like a chicken egg thing. Like probably before I started doing heroin, I want to say like I saw a therapist and they thought maybe I was like, I had like adult ADHD. So like I was put on Adderall for a little while. So I had sort of like a whole real crazy cocktail of prescription and illicit drugs like going on for like quite a period of time.
Life is better through chemistry. Sorry.
No, I remember, but I remember sort of like, I probably like didn't have like a baseline read on what my headspace was for a very long time, whether it was like, you know, being put on like psych meds or taking drugs or, I mean, that, cause I went through a whole like series of things. Yeah, and some of them were not great.
Yeah, well, and I think this is a time when sort of the industry itself, when we talk about psych meds, the whole psychiatric industry was going through a change. And I can remember, in my life when I was romancing the stone with cocaine off and on, that, you know, I had an intimate relationship for a number of years. And one of the things that was very common, especially during the late 80s and the 90s, were this notion that everyone was bipolar. But if you abuse drugs, that came off that way. So even, I mean, for me, that was stimulants. And so when I remember the first time I got diagnosed, they said, yeah, you know, do you have this and this? And I go, yeah, but, you know, the depressive states would have been coming down and not using, and that maybe lasts for 3 or 4 days, and then using, and then kind of being in a euphoric state and go, well, that sounds like maybe a young man. And I'm going, yeah, okay, sure. So,
yep.
you know.
Yes, I definitely went through that.
Lithium.
Like, yes.
You need lithium or Depakote.
Depakote was very bad.
Yeah.
I definitely spent about 6 months doing that.
Me too.
Yeah, no, I remember.
You didn't know we had so much in common, did you?
I didn't. I remember, in fact, like when I was on Depakote, which was after that first hospitalization, like I kept taking it, but then I was also like off and on with other things. And I remember I ended up hospitalized a second time at uni. And I remember after that, like seeing like my general practitioner and talking to him about it. And it was very funny because he was like, so you went off your meds? I was like, no. And he was like, oh, wow, you broke through the medication. Nice. It's like, I guess.
Your general practitioner said that?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I did. I guess that's pretty cool. I don't know.
sounds like something totally off the wall in some ways. Today, yes. In my understanding now. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, in some ways I was like, yeah, cool. My real personality came through these terrible drugs that made me feel like a cardboard person.
Right.
So
you were a little flat as well. Oh, that
very flat. Yeah, very. Like I remember that. I remember just not feeling like a human being. And yeah, and that was sort of, that was a weird, it was a weird experience to go through too. I don't even know. Like it's funny. Like there were sort of so many different, like different diagnoses and drugs going on that I like. The whole thing is a very weird like blur to me. Like I remember specific things, but like the chronology of it is not super clear to me.
Do you get the feeling though when you look back? It's like. And this is, I mean, I really this really impassions me, just so you know. This idea, especially during identity development, middle to late adolescence as we're going into early adulthood, and if there isn't some type of, you know, formation of identity at that point, and it's like a lot of people get, they either go way off into some kind of substance abuse place where they're, you know, they just want to medicate what they can't, haven't figured out yet necessarily, or they don't know how to process or emotionally regulate very well, or this idea of through psychiatry they want to figure out what's okay, you know, what are the limits of being, how should I behaving, what, who am I? I mean, that thought, who am I? So this idea of identity seems so correlated to psychiatry and substance abuse and mental health that I'm just more and more fascinated by it.
I also, like, speaking of identity, I also, like, the first hospitalization was really hard on me and my sense of identity because, like, I had always done really well in school, mm-hmm. and was, all, like, always sort of pegged as being, like, one of the quote-unquote smart kids, which, whatever, but also that was sort of really tied up in my identity, and then, so then to be, like, diagnosed as, like, quote-unquote crazy was like a real, like, oh, I thought my smart brain was the thing that, like, made me special, but maybe it's a crazy brain, like that. And that was very much like, oh, then who, what's my deal then? Like, right. Who am I if I'm not the smart person?
The smart person. My identity as the smart guy. Not knowing how romantically attractive the crazy is. It's just, it's the type of people that are attracted to it.
That's, yes. You have to be selective, I think.
Right. Okay, so when did you, at what point did this sort of like come to a head for you when you realized this isn't what you wanted to do anymore? I mean, at some point there was some, what do you want to call it, you know, self-actualization or something happens when that you kind of decide enough is enough, or this is not how I want to live any longer. Or
yeah. I mean, the short version of it is that, like, my family found out that I was using again, and they had an intervention, and I went to rehab, which, you know, I was already, I think, but I had already sort of before that hit the place where I was like, oh, this is just like, I can't keep doing this. Mm-hmm. but sort of, and probably, and I had actually, I've wondered if I did this to as a way to sort of get help that I didn't know I wanted, but like I told a friend that I was using again, and he ended up telling my family, and then I ended up having an intervention. And part of me is like, did you do that on purpose?
it was a cry for help.
I didn't. So, yes. Yeah.
So did I don't want to make light or fun of this a little bit, but what kind of intervention was it? Did they like have you sit down and
yes.
there was a psychologist there? Did they write letters and those kinds of
it
things?
It was exactly that.
Okay.
Yes. Right. Yes. I was invited home on some sort of pretense, and I walked in. And immediately I was like, oh no, I know exactly what this is. Everyone was sitting around the table. There was one guy there I didn't know. Everyone had an envelope with a letter in it.
I know we're making lighter humor of this, because in a way it's cliche, and I apologize for
once I was in the rehab facility, like, this was actually like one of the things that we would talk about and joke about was like, what happened to you? I remember I had a friend who, like, his family invited him over for a pizza party, and it was really an intervention, and no, there wasn't even any pizza. So, you know, it's... like, at least you want to get some pizza out of the deal. But yeah, it was very much that sort of like stereotypical ABC Family drama intervention, which was fine.
What was that called? The afternoon show or something? I can't remember.
The after-school special?
After-school special.
Yeah.
Intervention.
And at this point, I was probably like 25 or 26. And yeah, and it just sort of like, you know, been spinning my wheels and also like doing too many drugs, and it was definitely time to do something different anyway. Not that I was happy about it. I was definitely not happy about being shipped off to a facility.
Outside of Salt Lake?
I was actually It was actually here in Newport Beach. It was really close to where we are right now. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it was the whole, 90-day, detox, and then a 30-day lockdown facility, uh-huh. and then there's I don't even know if it still exists around here, but the place where you sort of do your last 60 days in this program was it essentially was there was a hub facility and then a bunch of sober living houses.
Sober by the Sea.
Yep. Okay. That is the one. I still have my jacket with the patch on it.
All right.
But yeah, and you would ride your bike to the facility and check in.
Yes.
If you didn't, then they would come looking for you.
And actually, that's a really good model, to be honest with you.
It was not bad.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of being accountable for that period of time, I think, is an important beginning to, make some decisions, Well, do I want to continue doing the life I'm doing? And I think also what happens in there is that we begin to go, oh, so, the drugs and the alcohol or whatever it is, sex, food, money, they're just a symptom of something else, too. So,
right.
So anyway, you did your stay.
I did.
You did your time, so to speak.
I did. Met some really interesting people. It was a very interesting 90 days. Yeah, and then came back out, and I think I ended up deciding to stay here. And, the 90-day thing at the time, when I came out here for rehab, I was dating somebody, which that was sort of part of my, I don't want to disappear for 90 days. That seems bad. But that sort of fell apart after I got out. But yeah, then so I ended up deciding to stay here in Newport Beach,
Did you guys have the house here at that point?
We did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So I was here. Yeah, I was here for a little bit, and then went back to school, which was fine. I have a hard time staying interested in school.
Really?
Yes.
Totally understandable.
Yeah. And then ended up... This is another period where I don't remember like the timeline of it. There's part of me that's that was a year later. No, it was 6 months later. Who can say? Literally no one. I was at school. I was not really enjoying it. I didn't love being 6 or 7 years older than everyone, which felt weird. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with it. It just feels you're there for different reasons. And so it's hard to relate to people, which felt isolating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I ended up taking a bunch of improv classes in LA at Upright Citizens Brigade Theater before it was the huge deal thing that it is now. And just met a lot of super weirdos that are all still my friends now, which is great.
So you met good people.
Yes. Yeah. And more than anything, I think that was kind of one of the things that really helped me. I did it with the intention of sort of relearning how to engage with human beings, because I felt I was not really doing that very successfully, and sort of needed to make myself do something that felt more...
This is that part of learning actually how to connect, right?
Yes.
And this is the beautiful part I love about your story, is that it's kind of where you kind of came into something in your life. I mean, you this group of people that you surrounded yourself with, and I know the improv part of you, and knowing trying to discover these different ideas of identity. And I know this sounds a little quirky, but what better way than doing improv?
I mean, I feel like I chose the most extreme way to learn how to reconnect with people. Like, let's do it in like on stage while like attempting to be funny. It was very weird. In hindsight, like I'm really glad I did it. It was a really strange decision. I didn't keep up with it at all, other than the friendships. But, yeah, it was a really...
That's the key, right?
Right, yeah.
Is that you connected with this group of people, and you found something and discovered something about yourself at the same time. And that sort of pulls you out, almost, and I'm not saying pulls you, but it sort of lifts you out of something when you feel that type of connect and that type of bond. And... Okay. I mean, So I listen to a lot of Pete Holmes, and I'm going to say this because Corey introduced me to Pete's podcast years ago, and this is one of the most awkward guys that makes it. He makes awkward. He does it so naturally, but there's something about discovering who you are and becoming vulnerable in front of people, and a way to do that. And I would never thought I would think of this, but standing up and acting or doing improv or doing comedy is a direct avenue to being vulnerable, because you see the person exactly how they are in that moment.
Yeah. And if you can't do that, if you don't do that, then you're not even doing it right. Like the whole, especially UCB, their whole philosophy was, don't think.
Yes.
Like, it's very much you're supposed to be in the moment, react in the moment, mm-hmm. You know, accept the reality that you're creating on stage. So just like be where you are. And it is, it's almost a shortcut to very quickly learning how to engage with people. I don't know if I recommend it to anyone, but it, yeah, it worked.
Well, just, I mean, this is, you know, I talked about this before we started today, and I was, you know, we were talking about the Gary Shandling episodes that are on HBO right now, the documentary on Judd Apatow's A Beautiful Piece, and then this whole idea that there's a similar thread here for a lot of people, that there's a way to discover and find oneself through this experience. And it just seems so powerful in different ways. So, I mean, I know it for some people listening to this may sound a little counterintuitive, but the truth is that whatever it takes for us to get out and get vulnerable and show up, whatever that looks like, whether it's right or wrong, and connect, it can lead to so many incredible things in our lives. But most importantly, discovering who the fuck we are. I mean, really, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the funny thing is that
you didn't have to agree with that.
No, I do, though. I do agree with it. And it's interesting, like, that you can... You don't necessarily know what those things are. It's a matter of just sort of, like, getting out there and putting yourself out there and trying things to make that connection. Because for me, the two most important sounds overblown, but like the two decisions I've made in the last 10 years that affected my life the most, weirdly, are one, deciding to do improv, even though I don't do it anymore. Like, I met so many people and like became a part of a community that was sort of all that was about one thing. And then also, like, maybe 4 or 5 years later, deciding to play adult dodgeball. Like, it was, which is the silliest, like, dumbest thing. But, like, again, just like met a bunch of like weird goofballs. Like, I mean, I met a bunch of people who also decided to play adult dodgeball. So they were already like a little bit, a little bit weird. And I was on a team for like a couple years and did that like regularly. And so some of that too, I think, is for me personally, as someone who has like a tendency to be an introvert and to isolate, like it was like, not only was it a fun, weird thing to do with weird people, but it was like, it was a thing on my calendar where I definitely left the house. I definitely saw other people. I definitely interacted. I definitely,
yes.
And, you know, and I think all that sort of makes a huge difference also. And, you know, I feel like there's a million different ways you can sort of get that in your life. But for me, it was improv comedy and dodgeball.
Dodgeball.
Which is very funny.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's going to be either a book or a TV show about this someday. or at least a script.
Yeah.
What do you call, or a treatment. I can't remember what these things are called anymore. Because there's the story, right? How do people find their way through this? That beautiful journey, whatever it looks like. And sometimes it gets down and dirty and messy, because just like that's what life is, you know. But I love the idea that what got me here, the two big decisions are doing improv and then getting on a dodgeball.
Getting on a
dodgeball team. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a metaphor about dodgeball, though, in here somewhere. So do you want to try it? You want to try for a dodgeball metaphor?
Ooh. No. Pass.
Good job.
But yeah, those things, like, I want to say 90% of my friends, like, I can trace directly back to those two decisions that I made.
Really?
Yes.
That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. 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 And yeah, and I mean, people I see like on a regular, like weekly basis are like my dodgeball friends, comedy friends. Yeah. Huh. It's been really interesting.
All right. Well, let's kind of shift gears a little bit.
All right.
You became a father
2010.
My gosh.
Sorry, I said my two most important decisions were doing comedy and joining an adult dodgeball league. I also had a child.
Yes, but and you probably, and maybe you wouldn't have had, I'm not saying you know, that's...
No, that's true. I actually, I met my son's mom through the LA comedy scene, kind of tangentially. So it's definitely like a direct result of that decision to start acting like an idiot on stage in front of people.
So how has being a dad, how has that changed your life? What have you noticed that predominantly that stands out now?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like my life is very different, but I don't know exactly how to pinpoint it. I mean, without saying stuff that's just like super obvious, like, oh no, there's someone in my life that's more important than me. like
it's true though.
It is
so true.
It's totally, like, I guess it's a cliche because it's true, but yeah, like I definitely,
but not that happens. That doesn't happen to everyone. There are plenty of people that have kids and they go, well, I don't care. I'm still going to do what I'm going to do. You know, that's not who you are. And knowing you before that and knowing you today, it has definitely shaped you in a different way. But I'm more interested in your experience. How you feel it has. Because what I noticed for myself is having kids, took me longer to figure this out, is that then I see life. I mean, I understand it. I see life through a different, slightly different filter system.
Yes.
I'm not seeing it the same as I was before when it was just, you know, all about me.
Yeah, definitely. And just like sort of re-experiencing things also, like through him, like sort of having experiences where you can sort of think to yourself, oh, I remember what that was like when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and like absolutely a whole new appreciation for my own parents being one now, like, oh, this is how you felt about me when I was doing all these things. And now, so yeah, so that's been interesting. Like I definitely can appreciate them in a new light. And
I wonder if this is almost like one of those moments where we look back and we go, oh yeah, my parents did know what they were talking about, or they were right about certain things.
There's some of that. And also on the flip side, some of like, oh, they didn't know what they were doing either. Just like I don't right now. And not in a judgmental way, just like, Oh, I feel like when you're a kid, you just sort of assume that your parents know what they're doing and they have a bunch of answers, and then you become a parent and like nobody gives you any answers and you're just totally making it up and you're like, oh, I guess they were too, and they did the best they could, and I turned out fine. And so
there it is.
Whatever I had some weird resentment about, like, I forgive them because clearly they didn't know anything special that I don't know. Like, they were just doing what they could.
Becoming a parent all of a sudden changes that lens that, you know, we realize that our parents are human and make mistakes. And, I mean, we probably thought that all along in some ways. Because I've been told that by my kids, you know, who do you think you are and why do you think you're doing this? And I don't know if you've said this yet, but I'm gonna imagine you have, but just because that's the story I want to tell myself, is that that line that, you know, parents say they're never going to say, which is, because I'm the parent.
Because I said so. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've definitely said it. Yeah. No, just because
I
said
so. When you hear it as a kid, it's totally different, right? Like,
yeah.
How dare you?
What are you doing? And I also think being a parent, like, I feel like there's a difference between, there's that sort of, that teenage sense of, like, you don't know shit, like, which is, like, kind of true, but as a teenager, you're offended by it.
Exactly, yeah.
And then as you get older and become a parent yourself, you're like, yeah, they didn't, but also, like, neither do I, and neither does anyone, and so, like, you can't really hold it against them that they don't know anything.
Yeah. So, which I'd love to talk about family values, but there's really, what the hell? It's all political anyway. So family values is what's in your heart. I'm going to move on if that's yeah. Okay. So you have your son and you kind of your energy and your life and your focus has changed over the years. You, instead of just planning your life around one person,
yeah,
it includes a whole nother human being.
Yes.
And, as a father, you put yourself second quite often. I mean, you still learn to balance though, right?
Yeah.
Between self-care, which is really important. So you find ways that you take care of yourself and still feed yourself. And you just said how, you know, you still have a lot of these friends that you met even, you know, prior. And so I know you're a big music fan because I live partly vicariously through your Facebook postings, you know, of the different shows you go to. And, you know, in Salt Lake, we don't have the ability to be embedded into what you have here, you know, musically.
It's funny, like, as a teenager, I was very much into, like, going to concerts and stuff. And I feel like that was something I, like, detached from when I was, like, doing drugs and just sort of figuring my own stuff out. And probably only, yeah, in the last like 5 or 6 years, I sort of reconnected with, like, oh, right, this was a thing I used to like doing all the time. And just started doing it all the time again. So, and it definitely, it's fun to connect with something like that and to because it's something I still enjoy, but also as like I used to do this all the time, kind of thing.
So moving on, just kind of in a similar vein. And I'm going to talk about this with relationships because, it kind of fits into, something we were talking about earlier, this idea. And in the book, I know I told you I wouldn't do too much of this, but, this idea between what a difference between a fixer and a saboteur is. And often, in relational dynamics, a fixer is someone that's in a relationship, that wants the person in the relationship to be better, or they want to take care of them, or almost sometimes their self-worth gets caught up in wanting that person to be okay. And it's almost as, that's my job. I'm here. I've got to make them better. I know you relate to this.
Yes.
if they would just get their shit together.
Boy, this person really would be great if they just got their act together. I really like them 60% of the time.
Right. And then that other person who often takes on the role of the saboteur. So, In throughout your life, you've been in multiple dynamics and obviously relationships, just like the rest of us. How do you identify those roles? And again, knowing that we can go in and out of them at any time, in fact, switch them in relationships too.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I've done some of both. it depends on how well things are going. If they're going too well, then I have to sabotage them. Mm. But
and what does too well mean, by the way?
I don't even know.
What's a normal relationship?
Yeah, exactly. You're talking to someone who has not been in a real relationship for probably like 5 years. But yeah, because I do feel like I've been on both sides of that. I feel like, and some of that I think is like self-esteem stuff, like. Where it's like, I don't, you know, where you get to a place where like, I don't even understand why you like me. So I'm going to make sure that you don't. I'm going to really like, I don't like me. There must be something wrong with you that you like me. So now I'm really just going to bring it all up. Like, let's really get all this bad behavior out here in the open.
You're going to meet Scary Corey.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really good point, is being in a situation where you were not understanding why we're even with someone to begin with. I mean, that question probably happens more than not. But a lot of people just don't like to even deal with it because the dependency to need or feel that they have to be in a relationship. But the role of the fixer, and I think, and maybe this comes with parenthood too. Do you know what I mean? Kind of that,
yeah.
You know, and we haven't, you know, and I'm going to jump the ship here just for a second. So, you're a dad, and that means that there's a mom.
Yes.
And do you feel that you in that relationship that you played the fixer a lot?
I don't know. That relationship feels particular to me out of all of them. I don't know. I don't have a good read on that for me, because I feel like it was maybe a relationship that went on a lot longer than it should have because we had a kid together. I feel like it would have sort of naturally fallen apart pretty quickly.
Oh.
And then we sort of tried to make it work when probably, like, otherwise we probably wouldn't have.
That's such a fascinating dynamic. That just that a lot of times, you know, oh, well, we're pregnant, so, you know, we've got to do these certain things, right? You know?
Yes.
So all of a sudden there's a family and we make everything work. And though, you know, through your comments there, the idea that how often probably that relationship wouldn't have gone on as long as it did, possibly because of that. I think that's a very common dynamic.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we're going to move on.
Okay.
So, any mentors? Any kind of mentors in life, or people that have sort of been a stalwart, you know, influence on you? That, you know, that north, that maybe that true north kind of thing.
Are you fishing for compliments here, Paul? Is this where I?
Oh God!
Is this where I admit?
I'm stopping
that...
right now.
No, don't stop.
Okay.
I get to give you a hard time about this, that I've looked up to you about stuff like this. Are we going?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No,
I didn't. Yeah, I didn't stop.
Look, no, I've definitely looked up to you as a mentor, as someone who is sort of, I mean, you talked about us having gone through a lot of the same stuff, and I'm like, oh, this guy now seems to have his shit together. And I mean, look, to a degree, and you know, have a family and have like a, just sort of a normal life. Cause I told you that some of my identity stuff around like being hospitalized, and it was like, oh, I'm not normal anymore. I'm a crazy person now.
Yeah.
And this is who I am, is I'm stuck as a crazy person. So that was definitely something that I took to heart, and that I like look to you as an example of someone who can sort of make it through that sort
of stuff.
Coming
through the crazy. Yes,
yes.
That's really important. And I fully agree. And I don't like the C word. That's the crazy word, by the way. But I also have learned to embrace it, understanding that it's just part of the psyche for a lot of people. And it's about going through, I mean, what do you want to call it? The dark night of the soul, you know, having that journey. Everyone needs to find a way through this. And I think the idea of becoming to understand who we are and getting into the complexities of our personality and our identity and trying to understand if, you know, why, who and why am I living for and why do I do what I do, that can get really messy and complicated and at times feel like, you know, that who am I and why am I here and why, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing and is this all worth it sometimes? You know, I think that's not, that's really normal. I mean, at least in my experience. So I relate to that. Yeah. Yeah. So you're welcome. But I it's been a mess. I mean, parts of it. Yeah.
No. Yeah. I'm glad to know though that it can be a mess, and you can still at least sort of fake your way into no, coming God, across
I've
as
got
a,
to edit this part out. I'm sorry. No, I'm good. Yeah. All right. Who else? Anyone else?
One of my friends, Jason, I met him through doing comedy. Mm-hmm. He was our neighbor when a friend of mine and I, we moved into this apartment complex. He ended up being our neighbor. He's like a comedy writer, director, and he's been really great about sort of helping me with my own writing and sort of my own kind of creative pursuits. He's been a really like an inspiration, and someone. He's also a dad. He's doing the creative stuff. He has like a family. He's really like inspiring to me in that way. In that like he's sort of doing all of the things and like really and also really like giving of his time and his creativity as you know in sort of helping other people figure out what they're trying to do.
Beautiful. So in today's world, I'm going to ask you a couple of different questions
because
I want to get as much in as we can here. What in this world today, what brings you the most disruption? What upsets you the most in this world? And I know that that's kind of a loaded question. I even realize asking it. And because it's kind of becomes a projection in some ways. So everyone has sort of, you know, different things that kind of twist them around a little bit and what's kind of goes on in the world. And, you know, I've heard people say, you know, we create this world. And I believe that. We create our reality. This is not happening to us, you know. This is like we get to create this from however, you know, what level of responsibility we want to take for it. But what kind of irks you? What kind of...
I mean, is this the part where I talk about how my new addiction is like the 5 Donald Trump podcasts that I listen to obsessively about all of the nightmare political stuff that's going on right now?
If you need to.
I mean, I don't know that I have anything constructive to say about it. It's just, you know...
No, okay. under that guise, though, right? That's a reflection of kind of where our world's at a little bit, at least from the United States perspective. I mean, that is our creation. I mean, regardless of other influences, it still happened, right?
And, yes.
You know, that's the way it's reality.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Yeah, and it feels almost unreal. I don't know that I have anything constructive to say about it other than like, I mean, I feel like part of why it happened is that I think enough of us got complacent that like things were just getting better and going to continue to get better. And
right.
Like, surely we wouldn't elect this maniac person to be our president, like that, because that would be less better.
Okay. Less better. So you don't believe that we deserve this then on some level?
I mean, maybe. I didn't say we don't deserve it, but no. Look, I do think that it's important that I mean, I think it's raised a lot of people's political consciousness. I think that a lot of people didn't think that this could happen, and the fact that it did happen, it means that the people that have a problem with this were not doing enough.
Yep.
They got complacent.
That's a really good point. And that's actually what I like about that, Corey, is this idea that I think there is a whole percentage of our population, maybe larger than we're aware of, that thought that maybe Obama would have never happened either. And when it did, it sort of created another sort of undertow, if you want to call it that, that sort of kind of brought up some of the old schemas of discrimination and bias and those kinds of things that were probably long running for a really long time and have been and continue to. And so this is maybe almost in a sense a reaction to that. Not that I agree with any of that, but it seems that sometimes these things kind of waver and the waves get, you know, I mean, to talk about this from I'm going to try this. Okay.
All right.
So if you were to look at this from, the mood swings of someone who's struggling with bipolar disorder.
All right.
That, you know, you have these high highs and these low lows. And it's like that's kind of seems where we're in right now. In if we're talking, you know, politically, if we're looking at things through the political lens, we've created almost a bipolar culture that's kind of pushing against each other. And I like the way you said we came out of this period where it seemed like there was a lot of hope and not to get too corny, but it did feel that way. I mean, for a lot of people, but there was a lot of other people that weren't feeling that way. And so it kind of creates, I mean, I'm, you know, jokingly say that, you know, I was diagnosed with that, but I would say right now in my ability to frame, our social and cultural, society right now, that there is some bipolar going on.
No, it's interesting. I'm going to be sketchy on the details, but I remember reading about, all of the Facebook and Cambridge Analytica stuff is what's been in the news the last month or so.
Yeah.
But I remember reading that part of the reason that, like, Donald Trump, his Facebook ads were so successful is because of how inflammatory they were.
Yes.
So speaking to that sort of like bipolar nature of things, like the fact that he's way over on one end of the spectrum means that like more people engaged with his content, whether that was positively or negatively. And
so his
ads like penetrated like through Facebook much more effectively than Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, that to look at that from sort of a dynamic of these huge mood swings, because it affects behavior too. I mean, that's what's so, I mean, in some ways, if you could kind of, I mean, maybe somebody did, if you could kind of bottle this up, you know, and understanding these formulas of how people react to certain kinds of information, this is such a, what a social study is here.
Right. And I think what we're finding out is that there are people who have bottled it up and then sort of know which buttons to push. Like, I feel like this is, I don't know if we'll ever know the extent of it, but I do feel like this is sort of what's coming out with like all of the Cambridge Analytica news is that they do know that this kind of content makes this kind of person engage in this specific way.
Yeah.
And those, and there's sort of a granularity to that where they know what sort of buttons to push and what levers to throw to sort of get people to react in certain ways.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's fascinating. It's very 1984.
It is 1984. And what it comes back to is understanding in some ways. I mean, I said we might talk about this. This is really a cool part. I talked with another friend of mine about on a podcast last week is this idea of free will and free choice, right? Because this is, I know it's scary at the same time, but it's like, it's almost as if we can predict how people will behave under these specific circumstances. And if there is a science to it, someone's figured out some of the formulas, because these things just don't, this is, I, again, life's messy. But also, we can kind of predict how outcomes of things are going to be if we understand sort of the physics or the math involved in it. And someone's got to figure out a formula here.
And I think also it's easier to predict how people will behave in the aggregate. Like, I don't think you can necessarily say, like, oh, if I showed Paul this Facebook ad, he's going to react this way. But I do think you can say, if we push this ad to this 1,000 people, about 600 of them are going to act this specific way.
Exactly. So that beautifully said. So, you know, not to the shift way out into the mental, political, and sociological zone here for a moment. But what's beautiful in some ways about this, even though I know it's frustrating, and is that humans are somewhat predictable within those aggregates, you know?
Right.
We can really get a feel for it. I mean, a feel for how they're going to behave under certain stressors. And that's why stress and anxiety and depression and all the things that kind of push us into becoming reactive create disconnection. You know, anxiety is a perfect example of that. And stress is a perfect example. We don't want to take the risk to reach out and connect and be vulnerable with people. And I think that if there's anything, then in some ways I look at this and the experiment that, if I want to say this was, you know, an experiment, and, you know, there are these different organizations involved with it. There are certain things we can count on from people when they are stressed, when they are sort of on the edge a little bit, and we can begin to predict their behavior. So learning to become vulnerable, learning to see the similarities instead of focusing on the differences all the time becomes a place that I think that it's about building bridges. And I know we can all sing Kumbaya, and that's not where I'm trying to go with this, but I'm trying to say, or what I feel is important to say here is that if we focus on the differences, that's what gets all the power.
Right.
And we miss all the commonality. And you know who did, I don't know if you watched Sarah Silverman show at all, I Love America or not?
I haven't watched her new show yet.
Okay, because she does this thing, and this is what I appreciate about learning about connection, and I appreciate about her, and I know she's a hot point for a lot of people, but she, you know, she would go into these communities that were very right wing or even alt right wing and sit down with these people in their homes. And the fascinating part was the connection that she made and focusing on the commonalities that she had with them instead of focusing on all the differences. And that was so cool to see and hear and watch, because going, you know, we're all just another bozo on the bus, man. It you're right. We have some different philosophies, but everyone's trying to get to the same fucking place. Everyone's trying to figure out how to do this dance, you know?
Right. And I do think there's something sort of very specific about like social media and the internet that rewards kind of extreme opinions.
Yes.
And yes. So the more we spend, this is not like a new thought or anything, but I do think that sort of the more we spend sort of engaging with people in that way, it makes people seem maybe more different than they are.
Sure. Yeah, of course. I used to think about this, by the way. So I'm gonna out myself a little bit here, because I used to think this way with music. So, you know, I remember I remember like in the 70s and listening to certain kinds of music, and I remember, you know, even though today I kind of laugh at it now. I mean, someone like Alice Cooper, you know, I would think, you know, why is, you know, that whole idea, I mean, why can't he just come up and play his music and play his songs? Why does he have to have all these theatrics associated with it? Or Ozzy Osbourne biting off the head of the bat and all this kind of stuff. I thought this, what's wrong with these people, right? Not realizing that this is this social experiment of going to the edge of things a lot is what pulls people in. You know, and then so then I find myself, this is what I see happening now too. I find myself judging those people that like this stuff, and I'm going, oh no, they're not, you know, and something's wrong with them. And there's nothing wrong with them. They just like the theater, the show, and all that. They're just, again, just another bozo, Just Another Rose on the West. You know where I'm going with this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, Marilyn Manson. I mean, I used to think that, you know, here are these problems, and this is the reason why, you know, and I sound like such a snob or a purist with music, but using this as an example, but that's how we get disconnected. And now I look back and go, I was a bit of a fool, you know, because I was judging and had bias towards these performers because of the way they presented, you know, the packaging, the theatrics, the, you know, of it.
Right.
So
interesting.
Yeah. That's my, okay. That
I was the kid that specifically put up a Marilyn Manson poster in my dorm room just to annoy my roommate. I didn't even like him that much.
See, that's what I'm talking about. If you want me to simplify that message, people voted for Trump just to piss somebody else off. Okay, I have friends that aren't going to talk to me after this. All right, let's move on. What brings you joy? What brings you joy in life?
I mean, going to concerts, friendship, just real basic stuff now.
Uh-huh.
Just being a dad. You know, we're right next to my kitchen, and every morning, like, I make breakfast and Jude sits at that counter and eats it, and we talk together, and, you know, just really
simple things.
Really basic, boring stuff.
Yeah. Love the boring stuff.
Yeah.
Love the boring stuff. You know, I think too, I kind of forgot, we haven't talked about this, and maybe we'll save it for another time, is the desert. We spent a lot of time in the desert together. And you worked with, you know, helping out with the retreats for a number of years. And we may go back this year. Hopefully.
Yeah.
It's been so long. I know. But that's, you know, that way of, there's something about that I, you know, getting out into nature and embedding into nature like that, that is so joyful. But it's also how, you know, I connect to that part of me. And I was always surprised, you know, sometimes who kind of connects with that, right? You know, and man, you just went right into it. And just like all of a sudden you were there, you know, it's just like it became part of your life for a long time. Not that it's still not part of your life, but what was that experience like for you? I'm curious.
It was really interesting. I mean, it's a totally different experience, I feel like, then. I mean, I think that's the attraction of it, at least partially, is removing yourself completely from your normal routine.
Unplugging. Yeah.
And you know, and some of that is, you know, checking your Facebook every day and, like, getting phone calls and emails. But some of it is just, like, removing yourself from the normal stuff you do every day.
Yes.
Which is, you know, and some of that's fine. Some of it's stuff you have to do. I have to wake up every day and drive my kid to school, which is totally fine. But, like, so much of that is autopilot that, like, once you remove yourself from that situation and sort of, like, I feel like your mind sort of unspools a little bit, and I can sort of
unspools. That's a good way to put it. I like that. Totally. That's like an unwinding.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's also a way to really develop mindfulness of being present in the moment, because shut off this internal dialogue, you know, the chatter.
Yeah. Very much.
All right. So let's move on to, God.
All right.
Faith. Oh, wait. What is it? Douglas Adams. I can't believe I can't remember that. Life, the universe, and everything, or whatever it
is. Yeah,
it means life, the universe, and everything. How do you find that in your life? Whatever it is. I mean, and it can be, I mean, you know, it can be anything. It, you know, it can be the desert. It can be going to church. It can be meditation. It can be, how do you connect that way to some spiritual part of your life?
I mean, I think mostly for me, it's my friendships and relationships with other people. We talked about this right before we started, but My son, just maybe in the last 6 months, is very freaked out about what happens after you die.
Oh, he's got existential moment.
Yes. Okay. And it probably like started small a couple years ago. He had like a couple kind of like crazy things happen, like one right after the other. Our dog had an accident and like lost an eye, and he's the one that like found her with her eye like sticking out. And I think that was sort of like really traumatic for him. And like a terrible thing can happen to your body. Uh-huh. And then like a couple months after that, like we were on an escalator and like his foot got stuck, and like it kind of, he's totally fine, but like it sort of chewed up his foot and he was stuck, and like he thought he was going to die, which it's kind of like, it's super sad, but also like thinking about it in hindsight, it's a little bit funny, like how totally panicked he was, which like obviously I'm sympathetic and feel bad, but like he was like knowing now that like,
well, his perspective on life.
Of course, right? Perspective, I'm sure he was terrified.
Yeah.
And I do, like, but yeah, like he, but those two things happened to him, like, kind of back to back in, like, within the span of about 3 months. And I think he really started thinking about, what happens when you die. But, like, and then he sort of, like, I don't know if he stopped thinking about it or he just stopped talking about it. But then in the last 6 months, he's gotten very, like, what happens?
Hmm.
And I'm like, I don't know. Nobody really does. A lot of people have a lot of different ideas.
It's son. It's like a light switch. So.
Oh no! Don't say that.
I'm kidding. It's not.
No, I mean, it's also.
I was listening to Pete Holmes talk about this. You know this, and I'm sorry.
This
idea of the wave, right? Like you become part of the ocean, and instead of lots of people believe in reincarnation, and so I don't know what your thoughts on that are, if you have a sense for that, but this idea that, you know, everything is all one, energy is energy. You know, if you want to go, Hawkins Einstein-esque or something on this, it's almost as if there's a collective of energy and we become part of that, whether it be an ocean or a universe or whatever. And I'm not here to define what that looks like and how you people want to label it, or they want to hold an image or a belief about it. But they're energy is energy. I mean, eventually it kind of all gets back together again, I guess. I don't know.
No, I don't know either. I mean, there's definitely...
Wait, you don't know?
No, I don't.
Shit!
Sorry. Okay. Is that what you came here for? No, there was something very, like, very strange about... I'm trying to remember exactly what he said. I feel weird the way I'm talking about him, because I'm trying not to use... His name.
You're doing really good.
But I feel like it has led to me talking about him in kind of a convoluted way. But what did he say? There was a couple things he said where I was, because he was just like, he knows the word abyss at 7 years old, and he's like, is it just abyss forever? And I was like, I don't know. I do know that when I've thought about that, it scares the shit out of me. So don't say that again.
That's awesome. That's incredible. That's incredible.
But it was very interesting to have the experience of trying to comfort someone about something that is also, at least medium terrifying to me also.
Sure. Well, it explains why we have make up so many stories about it, right? Because there's thousands of stories about this, right?
You know? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it was tempting to sort of be like, well,
I'm going to be damned no matter what I say here. So.
No, exactly. Like, I feel like there's a way to say it that sounds condescending, where it's like, oh, we're all going to be together. And which, as far as I know, that might be true. I don't know.
Well, if it's a collective of energy, then that will be true.
Yes.
Because our energy will all form into one ocean of energy.
And I tried to be sort of as comforting as I mm-hmm. could while also saying, like, nobody really knows for yeah. sure what happens, but, like, lots of people have lots of different ideas.
Isn't that the Alan Watts thing is, you know, the wave or the particle, right? But so yes. when we identify ourselves as individuals, we're a particle. But as soon as we transcend that, we become just a wave within the ocean of all energy.
Yeah. Sounds nice.
So I don't know if that's something, you know, a 7-year-old would understand, but there's a sort of comfort in that in some ways, I think, if it's said properly. And you can find out and then let me know if I'm full of shit or not.
Fair enough. I'll tell you how it goes over with him.
So you can say, my friend Paul has this idea.
Look, do you know how light is both a particle and a wave?
Yeah.
Have you learned that yet? And just stares at me.
Yeah, quantum physics, man. It's where it's at. Okay. You ready for the final question today?
Are we there?
Yeah.
Is it happening? Okay. Okay. I'm ready.
So, I mean, we can, you know, this is that piece that where you have an opportunity, if you're so inclined to, is to share if there was a soundtrack for your life or a celebration playlist for your life. Share with me, if you would, a couple songs that may be on that playlist or that soundtrack.
Okay. This might just be because I've been obsessed with this album for the last 6 months, but almost for sure, Another World by Joe Jackson off of Night and Day, which is, I think, a totally underrated album.
I totally agree with you,
it's
by the way.
It's so good.
It is. It brings so many genres together, and it's still poppy on some level. It's remarkable. But it's really a jazz album. I mean, a lot of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, which is interesting, since he was sort of like the forefront of kind of like early new wave, and then all of a sudden he switched to this almost loungy album, but there's parts of it that make me think of like Mike Patton mm-hmm. from Faith No More, like yeah. some of his vocals, which I've never associated with Joe Jackson ever before. But yeah, that whole album has been in heavy rotation lately. But Another World is my favorite track.
And you know what else has a little bit of a feel for that is it was Stevie Wonder's, like, what was it? Oh my gosh! But the Innerness or
Innervision. Yes,
there's some songs on that that remind me, also speak to me of Joe Jackson. We're talking, you know, decades apart. I mean, well, yeah, maybe a decade and a half.
Yeah, probably.
Apart.
Yeah,
yeah. That the between that, but it had some of that similar kind of energy, and his, you're right, his vocals were remarkable. I mean, I kind of see somewhere when I think about this. And I'm sorry to go off on this, but I've always loved that album. So when I saw you post something about it, I was like, oh my gosh, someone else just thinks this is awesome too.
It's so good.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And Steely Dan, that was it. That kind of reminds me of some of Joe Jackson stuff too.
I can hear that too. I feel like Joe Jackson is less like precise in his instrumentation than Steely Dan. Like, I feel like those guys were huge production nerds. But yeah, I definitely hear a lot of that too.
They were definitely production nerds. Sometimes 100 takes on something. Yeah, they were production nerds. I don't know if it's out of the cocaine. Anyway, sorry.
Get it just right, man.
So, okay. Anything else on that
playlist?
That's
what comes immediately to mind. I don't know. We'll just put that one track on repeat.
Okay.
As they lower me into the ground.
Okay. So, are you going to be in a coffin, or are you going to get cremated?
That's a good question. I hadn't really thought about it. Yeah. I was just sort of thinking of your, you know, traditional funeral.
Like, it
does seem. I mean, it does seem like excessive to sort of, you know, make a whole production where they put me in a box after I don't care anymore.
Okay.
All right. Who knows? Whatever.
You'll be dead.
Whatever my family wants to do with my stupid body.
Yeah.
Like, go ahead, I guess.
So, my mom did. I don't know if you know this or not, but
I don't know either.
My mom, she didn't do it. What am I saying? She didn't do this. I don't know. But we each got a portion of her, the kids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and she sits in my in the drawer in my living room.
Sure.
Mom's always around.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, right. So I've thought of doing that, too. You know, just do whatever you want with it. Or, you know, people say, where do they want their ashes spread? Those kinds of things. I always thought, you know, the only thing I've come up with is the three sisters and, you know, this ocean out here.
It seems pretty good.
Yeah. So, yeah, the three sisters. Yeah. That's a desert reference. All right. Corey, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Of course.
For today.
Thank you. It's been really great.
And we go out as we always do. Oh, and by the way, before we do, hopefully here in the months to come, Corey's going to interview me.
Revenge.
Revenge on this podcast. So look forward to that sometime late spring, early summer. But we'll go out with a little Joan Osborne, as usual. Talk to you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Look like, and would you want to see if sleep-